Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. Is war making in our genes? Have we inherited it from a common ancestor of humans and the chimpanzees? Here's an expert science writer who says the science suggests otherwise.
This idea of humans as being descended from sort of killer apes goes way back. The problem is that it's been a couple of dozen of these incidents that have been seen. These are very, very rare actions by chimpanzees.
Will humans inevitably be led to war by resource scarcity and climate change?
It just doesn't stand up to empirical scrutiny. Economic factors were actually not a significant factor in a majority of wars.
Or do we perhaps continue to have war because we continue to invent excuses for why we must?
It's not just a few people who have this fatalistic belief that we've always fought and we always will. It's the vast majority of people.
I am delighted to welcome to the program this week John Horgan. John teaches and directs the Center for Science Writings at Stevens Institute of Technology, Hoboken, New Jersey. He writes regularly for Scientific American, The Chronicle of Higher Education, and BBC Knowledge Magazine, among other publications. He is also a science correspondent for bloggingheads.tv, an internet chat show. His previous books include The End of Science, The Undiscovered Mind, and Rational Mysticism. He lives in New York's Hudson Valley, and his new book, about which we will be speaking, is The End of War, possibly the best book I have read in the past several years. John Horgan, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
David, it's really a pleasure to be here, and thanks for saying such nice things about my book.
Well, I don't make it up. I can't be paid to make stuff up and have lost jobs for refusing. So I honestly think that we would be much better off if people read this book because it's such a persuasive case that we can end war and are perhaps in the process. We often run across people who will say war has always been with us. It's a fantasy. It's naive to suggest we could even get rid of it. It's in our genes. What do you say to that?
It's not just a few people who have this fatalistic belief that we've always fought and we always will. It's the vast majority of people. I've actually been doing surveys for, 7 or 8 years now of people's attitudes. I survey every class that I teach here at Stevens Institute. So these are young people who want to be engineers and scientists. But every time I have a captive audience, I put this question to people. Do you think there will ever come a time when humanity stops fighting war once and for all? And about 90% of the time, people say no, and often they say hell no, as though it's stupid and naive even to raise the possibility of a world without war. And then people often cite these scientific theories that supposedly show that war goes back millions of years to the common ancestor that humans had with chimpanzees, and there has been this continuous mass slaughter for all of human prehistory right up to the present. War is really deeply ingrained in human nature, and that's why there's no hope of transcending war and militarism at any time in the future. So I really wrote my book to confront that fatalistic attitude, which I think has real-world consequences. I think it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think it leads to hawkish policies. If you think that the world is always going to be a really dangerous place and it's filled with enemies and potential enemies who might attack us, then of course we need to maintain a very strong military to protect ourselves, and therefore war persists for that reason. So I wrote this book to attack this notion, which I've found not only in among a somewhat naive college students, but going all the way up to the top levels of power. Even Barack Obama has been infected by this belief that we really can never get rid of warfare.
I have no doubt there's some variation around the planet on that question. I wonder what variation there's been through the decades. It seems back in the 1920s, there was a very mainstream movement to end war in this country that even put a treaty on the books that ended war among the wealthy nations of the world, with the one exception of World War II. And yet this was sort of right before polling got going.
In my book, I cite some polls that were done in the 1980s by a psychologist named David Adams, and maybe 30-40% of the students were very fatalistic, and they said that human nature is basically warlike, and therefore there will always be wars. You know, that was an alarming number of people even back then, but people are much more fatalistic. So over the last few decades, this pessimism has grown, and I think it has to do with, at least in part, not just because of all the wars that the U.S. is embroiled in, but also because of these scientific theories that supposedly demonstrate that humans have an innate predisposition to war, and that males in particular are, as one scientist put it, natural-born warriors. So I spend a good portion of the beginning of my book focusing on that theory and showing how absolutely flimsy it is.
Let's go to these theories. What is your refutation of the idea that war is in our genes? We could use eugenics, we could take oxytocin, but it's in our bodies.
So this idea of humans as being descended from sort of killer apes goes way back. Freud and William James subscribe to different versions of it. You can see it being depicted at the beginning of the classic film 2001, where you've got the one ape person who, in an epiphany, grabs a bone and bashes the brains out of another ape. And the modern version of this theory derives from observations of chimpanzees banding together and from one troop and raiding members of another troop and killing them. There's a scientist at Richard Wrangham who says that since chimpanzees are our closest relatives, this demonstrates that war is embedded not only in human nature, but even in our pre-human ancestors going back millions of years. This theory has become very popular. It's been accepted as dogma by people like Steven Pinker at Harvard, E.O. Wilson, and so forth. The problem is that it's been a couple of dozen of these incidents that have been seen over the past few decades. It comes out to about one incident for every 7 years of observation. Even Richard Wrangham admits that these are very, very rare actions by chimpanzees. And most scientists I've spoken to say that this is probably a very recent behavior that's a response to human encroachment on chimpanzee habitats. Jane Goodall herself thought that this was the most likely explanation of chimpanzee raiding. She watched chimpanzees for 15 years in Tanzania without ever seeing one of these incidents. So I think the whole idea of us being descended from killer apes is, there's just absolutely no evidence for it.
John Horgan is my guest. His book is The End of War. John, what about the encroachment that humans are feeling from each other on this finite planet? As resources grow scarce and the climate goes crazy, whether we might behave well in paradise or not, we will inevitably have wars with each other.
Yes, I have encountered a lot of this kind of fatalism among people on the green left, progressive environmentalists. Bill McKibben, for example, in his recent book, Earth, cites the theory that war stems from too many humans fighting over too few resources. It's basically a Malthusian theory that you get conflict inevitably because of overpopulation in a region with finite food, water, oil, whatever the really crucial resources are. The problem with this theory is that it just doesn't stand up to empirical scrutiny. So when you look at tribal societies, for example, There are some societies like the Yanomamo in the Amazon, who have been studied since the 1960s, where there's an inverse correlation between population density and availability of food and the intensity of warfare, so that the more sparsely populated a given region is, the more likely the people are in that area to fight. Also, there have been studies of more recent wars over the last two centuries by a British scientist named Lewis Fry Richardson, who wrote a very quirky but brilliant book called The Statistics of Deadly Quarrels. He looked at a whole range of economic and demographic factors in causing different wars, from World War II and World War I to very small, localized wars. And he found that economic factors were actually not a significant factor in a majority of wars. So this idea that inevitably, because of climate change, that we're going to have ferocious, deadly fighting over increasingly scarce water, for example, which McKibben and others talk about, is just not supported by the facts.
This is Talk Nation Radio. This is David Swanson. My guest is John Horgan, the author of a wonderful book, The End of War. John, you suggest in your book that what does predict whether there is war or how frequent war is the culture in a society, that war is essentially an idea, a meme, and if we accept war as something acceptable, we will have it, and if we reject it, we will not have it. Surely it's not that simple, is it?
Well, yeah, the favorite explanation I've found of war dates back to Margaret Mead, the great anthropologist, who is really disparaged these days by a lot of scientists. Modern scientists like to depict Margaret Mead as this kind of dotty, romantic, sentimental liberal who projected her fantasies about some kind of utopian society onto the various people that she studied. And I urge your listeners to go and read some of Mead's essays and books, and you will see how tough-minded she is and how she is not in the slightest bit sentimental about thinking about how humans behave. But she has this wonderful essay about war called War is Not a Biological Necessity, War is an Invention, that was published in 1940, you know, when the world was erupting into mass violence. And she described war as this an invention, a cultural innovation in modern lingo, a meme that can arise for an enormous variety of reasons. Maybe it does arise because of competition for land or other scarce resources. Maybe it's a group of men in one village who covet the woman in another village. It can start as an interpersonal fight that escalates into a feud between villages and families. Maybe you've got a charismatic psychopath in one village who just wants to fight for the fun of it and drags other people along with him. War can arise for a number of reasons, but once it arises, it transforms cultures. And the problem with war is that it's an infectious meme. So if you have one violent, aggressive society in a region of pacifists, that violent society will gradually transform the whole region into a warlike area, because the other societies have no choice when confronted by an aggressive neighbor but to either submit or to fight in self-defense, or even if they suspect that they're going to attack, to lash out in a preemptive strike. And as a result of this kind of behavior, cultures elevate the fighting skills and martial virtues to the most admired traits of their society. And in that way, war also becomes self-perpetuating. I think this is a much better way of understanding why war persists and why it's so hard to stamp out than seeing it as some kind of simple result of biology and especially innate male aggression, or as the inevitable result of resource scarcity.
John Horgan, I wrote a positive review of your book, The End of War, and one of the arguments that I got back from some readers was that our society appears to be fairly opposed to war. We have a majority of people in polls who oppose wars that are ongoing despite that opposition. We have a majority of people in polls that want to defund the military and fund other priorities. And we don't seem to be inevitably pushed into wars by the threat of the Canadians or the Mexicans. We seem to have an elite criminal cabal that manipulates the society, that tells people to be afraid, and then drives us into wars whether we've bought their propaganda or not. And the objection that people were giving me was that you were letting the war makers off the hook by suggesting that war comes and goes with majority opinion.
Yeah, well, David, you might have your finger on the pulse of the anti-war movement. You certainly do better than I, but I have to look at the fact that maybe not a majority of people, but a lot of people voted for George Bush to be elected for a second term after he had already got us involved in two absolutely catastrophic wars. And unfortunately, Barack Obama, I'm sure you share my dismay at the hawkishness of Obama in his first term, but probably the fact that he's carrying out drone assassinations and got Osama bin Laden and has been pretty tough as a president will help him get elected, because a lot of people like to see that. So unfortunately, I do think that there's a lot of anti-war sentiment out there, but unfortunately too many people in our country still see war as morally acceptable in some situations. And even when we are confronted with the inevitable horrors of war, like this recent, the massacre of civilians in Afghanistan by a single soldier, or by the inevitable collateral damage of drone strikes, it occurs over and over again. People just sort of shrug and say, well, that's just the cost of waging war. I think for us to get rid of war once and for all, we do need to have a kind of moral awakening and to recognize the unacceptability of war, how wars just aren't justified, given all the damage done to warriors, to soldiers, as well as to all the other innocent bystanders in a conflict zone. I think we need to have the same kind of absolute revulsion toward war that we had toward slavery, that helped to eliminate slavery once and for all. And I think we're already seeing that around the world. We actually are in a period that is relatively peaceful by historical standards. In the last decade, there have been fewer people killed in wars around the world than in any decade in the 20th century, so that's a good sign. But we also need to have leaders who have the courage and imagination to help us envision a world without war and help us get to a point where war between any two nations becomes as inconceivable as war is now between the U.S. and Canada. And I think that's possible, but we do need to have this moral awakening.
Well, needless to say, it's possible. I think that we are in a period where we no longer have wars between rich armed nations. We think of the idea as almost crazy, and we've outgrown it. But wars fought by wealthy armed nations against poor unarmed nations in the world yes, have become not only acceptable to many. I have to disagree a little bit with the idea that how we choose between two war-making presidential candidates is a good measure of how we feel about war, since we aren't given any other choices. But I think
that
and needless to say, if we universally put war in the category of slavery or infanticide or cannibalism or where torture was 12 years ago, we could get rid of it even with our corrupt system. But we seem to have a nation in which we have given war-making powers to a single individual, whoever is president. We have enriched a military-industrial complex that eats half the federal discretionary budget and funds many of the congressional campaigns. We have become a war economy. And many in both of the political parties that supposedly we have this great choice between, you have not just acceptance, but promotion of humanitarian war.
Yes. One area, one factor that my book should have dwelled on in more depth is the role of, let's say capitalism in promoting war. The military-industrial complex you alluded to, companies like Halliburton or Lockheed Martin that clearly benefit from conflict or the threat of conflict for maintaining a strong military, ensuring continued arms sales, and so forth. That is definitely a big part of the problem. On the other hand, I actually see capitalism as overall a progressive force. And what I tell people is, look at Google. Look at the companies that are really making money these days on a global scale. Look at Google. Look at Apple. Look at Amazon. The executives of these countries of these companies, they don't want war. They want barriers between nations to be diminished so that they can find more markets overseas. And yes, there are some people who benefit from war, but I think all of us can agree that economically, for most people in this country, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been an absolute disaster economically. So even putting morality aside, I think we've reached the point in human history where most rational people can agree that war makes no sense. It is irrational behavior. Then we can get down to the humanitarian, so-called humanitarian wars, our intervention in Libya. Should we intervene in Syria? Some of these cases are really difficult. I am not a total pacifist. I think there are certain situations where perhaps a limited armed intervention might be the moral thing to do, but I think we find excuses to do this far too often right now. I don't think we should have intervened with armed force in Libya, for example, because I think that the symbolism of that act, the suggestion that violence was a solution to what was going on in Libya, helps to perpetuate war itself. It helps to legitimize war in the future. It makes it harder for us to take the moral high ground against the Syrian government when it's attacking its own people and rebel movements. Probably the hardest problem that anti-war people are facing now, and even a legitimate anti-war president like Denis Kucinich, would be, what do you do about those situations when there is some kind of horrific crime going on in the world? When do you decide to use force? And if you don't use it, what should you do? But I think we can solve that problem if we go about it in good faith.
But, John Horgan, your book is called The End of War, and yet you seem to be 99.5% there on wanting to end war. I mean, when we talk about slavery, we never consider the possibility of a good situation for slavery. We never imagine there are just and humanitarian rapes. I mean, there are certain crimes we have decided are absolutely beyond the pale. And with war, we have those who say Libya was good, those who say Kosovo was good, those who say the first Gulf War or the imagined intervention in Rwanda that didn't happen. And I would say we needed police in Rwanda. We needed a different policy toward Rwanda for the preceding 15 decades, but bombing Rwanda would not have helped anybody. And there is no imaginable situation in which going in and bombing somebody else's country could possibly help anybody. And as long as we imagine there might be, we have the people who get that $1 trillion a year, that banker bailout every year that we never get back, have a strong case to make. We might need them next month.
I think we're actually in agreement on this. I am attracted to something called, you know, so everybody knows what just war theory is. It's an attempt to come up with a set of moral guidelines for how you decide to wage a war in the first place, and then how you go about conducting that war once it starts. There's a concept called just policing, which says that we should use police work as a model instead of conventional military strategy. And you know, what does that come down to? I think the biggest criterion by far is that you don't kill civilians ever. And if you are bombing a region, almost certainly that means that you will be killing civilians. You also try as best you can not even to kill combatants on the other side. You try to capture them and bring them to justice. Just policing also addresses the issue of rhetoric. You don't demonize the enemy. You don't associate all people who belong to a certain group, all people within one nation or belonging to one religion, as being the bad guys. You try to focus on the people who really are a direct threat. And then you use minimal force in the way that police would when confronted with a violent criminal in this country. And then you try to bring them to justice. And I think if we had a military policy like this, this could be kind of a bridge to a world without war. And I think very quickly, in fact, I think it's happening now, you'd be dealing with situations where it wouldn't be one nation against another. You'd be dealing with very small, violent groups, apocalyptic religious cults, for example, that chose to use violence. And I think it's the possibility that we will always have groups like that, that we will always need some kind of protective force, maybe a kind of international police force administered by the UN, just to protect us against apocalyptic religious or political nuts, if you will. But that will be a tiny fraction of the size of our military now.
Well, that is very, very well said, and I couldn't agree more. What do you think of the idea that nonviolent action presents an alternative to war that can help in persuading people that we can make that change?
I'm glad you asked. One of the people I admire most in the world is the political scientist Gene Sharp, who has an enormous range of books and papers that talk about how nonviolent activism can be used to topple dictators, to right wrongs in unjust regimes, to bring out basically any kind of political change that you like without violence, and that there is a giant empirical database showing how effective nonviolence can be. His works were inspirational in the Arab Spring uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt. If everybody who has a grievance against their government adopted the strategies of Gene Sharp, we would be in a world without war right now.
Very well said. You've been listening to Talk Nation Radio. My guest has been John Horgan, the author of the wonderful new book, The End of War. John, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me on, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christian Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.